project in the region as their kind of military base to disrupt the region and maintain hegemony and control over people's destiny, future, and resources. And it's the Palestinian resistance and their allies in the Lebanese resistance and all the forces of the resistance in the region and around the world that are actually standing up on the front lines to confront that imperialism and create a better future for all of us everywhere in the world.
All right, thanks a lot. Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Feroz Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and also International Coordinator at Samdoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. Thanks for contributing to the program, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, "My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the all-hearing, the all-knowing." And when she bore her, she said, "My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne, and the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan." Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, "O Mary, from where does this come for you?" She said, "It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
People in Turkey head to the polls in key presidential and parliamentary elections, seen as a litmus test for President Erdogan and his ruling party. In Egypt, brokered ceasefire comes into effect in the besieged Gaza Strip, after 5 days of Israeli strikes that claimed over 30 Palestinian lives. And people hold rallies across the world to mark Nakba Day and denounce Israeli atrocities in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Welcome to the studios from the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Polls have opened in Turkey in the country's key presidential and parliamentary elections. The elections are a litmus test for President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ruling Justice and Development Party, or AK Party. Incumbent Erdogan is among four candidates approved by the country's electoral body. According to opinion polls, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, leader of the main opposition, is the frontrunner in the presidential race. 64 million people are eligible to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Around 2 million Turkish nationals living abroad have already cast their votes. The runoff is expected in 2 weeks' time if none of the presidential candidates crosses the 50% threshold necessary to win the race. Correspondent Roshan Saglam joins us from Istanbul to tell us more about the election. So, Roshan, what do you have for us?
Yes, it is an unexpected participation in this election. We are seeing people coming from all ages to the polling stations to cast their votes. As you mentioned, some 64,113,941 voters will be casting or are eligible to cast their votes today in Turkey. And also some 2 million were able to do that abroad outside of Turkey through the embassies and consulates related to Turkey. Now, as I mentioned, the participation is unexpected, especially from the youth. I think that this is the most election that has the highest number of participants or voters in the history of Turkey. And this is due to the competition between whether the presidential candidates, be it the main two presidential candidates, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for the People Alliance and Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the opposition for the opposition alliance, the Nation Alliance. Also in the parliamentary election, we have a high competition between those alliances and other three alliances and also other political parties. We have 24 political parties running for the parliament, 151 independent candidates, and we have five alliances. And as I mentioned, the election is very important. Whoever is going to win this election is going to move with Turkey in its another 100 years of age. Of course, we are speaking about the modern Turkey after the Ottoman Empire. We have already finished 100 years, and President Erdogan has spoke about this importance. Also, it is very important for the foreign policy of Turkey. Whoever is going to rule this country, whoever is going to become the president and going to have the government under his rule, he is going to change the foreign policy of this country. We are going to see whether we are going to continue with the AK party, the Justice and Development Party, or we are going to witness a change after 21 years of the rule of the AK party. Now, many analysts are saying that Kılıçdaroğlu may be slightly ahead of President Erdogan in the presidential run. However, it is Turkey. Nothing is predictable in Turkey, especially when it comes to politics and elections. We are still waiting. We have spoken to some of the youth that are in the background, and some of the people who are still casting their vote. Some of them, or the majority of them here where we are, said that they are voting for the opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. However, I have to mention here that where we are is a opposition stronghold. It is we are in Beşiktaş. It is one of the main opposition strongholds in Istanbul. Actually, in all of Istanbul, there are three opposition strongholds. One of them is Beşiktaş, another is Kadıköy, and also the area of Maltepe and Bostanji. Now, in the afternoon, we are going to also move to areas where the AK party, the Justice and Development ruling party, is strong over there, to see how the vote is going. And also circulating the media, looking at the social media, at Twitter, how people are reacting to this election. People are calling others to start voting, to go down and vote. And they also, some people are calling foreigners who got the Turkish nationality, whether they're from Arabic origins or Western origins, to go and cast their votes, because there is fear that if those who got the Turkish nationality in many other ways, that they were able to get it from Syrians, Egyptians, Palestinians, recently they've been able to get this nationality, if they did not cast their vote, and if President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was not able to make it again and become the president, there is fear that those people, they could lose the Turkish nationality that they were given to by a presidential decree from President Erdogan. So this fear is actually pushing them to go down to the ballot boxes and cast their votes. Also, when it comes to the opposition, the youth, that they are voting strongly for the opposition candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, they are saying that they are voting for a change. They are voting for a new president, a new era in Turkey's history. They are voting for freedom, and they want a better economy in the country.
Russian, quickly, if you can you tell us a little bit about the interference that has been cited? One was leveled against Russia, and President Erdogan made some references to perhaps outside interference coming from the West, and maybe having the U.S. To have accused the U.S. of that.
Well, as usual, yes, President Erdogan did say that the West, and especially the United States and President Joe Biden, are interfering in Turkey's election directly, whether be it by supporting the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu or by trying to do propaganda against President Erdogan. Yes, he did speak about that. And also Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, he spoke a few days earlier that there are some interferences coming from Russia, and he did accuse Russia directly and President Putin of that. And he said that Russia is directly interfering in Turkey's election, and he called Putin, the Russian president, to stop interfering in those elections. He said that they are trying to fabricate some kind of videos against the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and falsifying some information. Also, I have to mention that the fourth presidential candidate, Muharrem Ince, who withdrew from his candidacy to the presidential run, he also spoke about some videos being fabricated against him, and he said that he was pressured to withdraw from this run. So, yes, there are some interferences, be it from the United States or from Russia. As I mentioned again, this is Turkey, this is the elections. It's not only a Turkish election, this election, and whoever becomes the president of Turkey is not only important for the Turkish people and Turkey, but also for the whole region and for the whole world internationally. This will actually decide, the foreign policy of Turkey will actually decide how Turkey will act towards anything happening in the region, from the Syrian unrest, from the borders, from what's happening in Ukraine, the war in between Ukraine and Russia, and other issues, of course.
Thank you for that. Russian Saglam, they're live from Istanbul. We appreciate it, Russian. Thank you. After 5 days of Israeli strikes in the Gaza Strip, a ceasefire has officially come into effect in the besieged territory. The Egyptian-mediated truce ended the worst episode of fighting since the 10-day war in 2021. Palestinian resistance movement Islamic Jihad said that it would abide by the ceasefire as long as Israel does. In a statement, the Joint Operations Room of the Palestinian Resistance Factions also said the Palestinian resistance groups are stronger than before. The latest Israeli violence erupted when regime targeted a number of residential areas in Gaza on Tuesday, killing several Islamic Jihad commanders. A total of 33 Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in 5 days of Israeli attacks. In response, Palestine resistance groups fired over 1,200 rockets towards Israel, targeting as far as Tel Aviv. An Israeli settler was also killed and dozens more injured. People across the world have held rallies to show solidarity with Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. The rallies come ahead of the anniversary of the creation of the Israeli regime known as the Day of Nakba, or Catastrophe. Rallies were held in many cities across the world, including in Vienna, Rotterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Toronto. The demonstrators also slammed the world's inaction and silence over constant Israeli atrocities, calling on governments and international organizations to take immediate action to help stop the regime. In London, the protesters chanted slogans denouncing the UK's role in the creation of the Israeli regime. Nakba Day marks the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948, when Zionists who had moved to Palestine from various countries committed ethnic cleansing there and colonized the land of Palestinians. The process saw over 750,000 Palestinians into exile and more than 500 towns and villages wiped from the map.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession, and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing. As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, Those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
Thousands marched in Paris to commemorate 75 years since the Palestinian Nakba, which means catastrophe, the imperialist slaughter and theft by Israelis on a horrific scale in 1948. To achieve their goal of conquering Palestine, Israelis immediately turned 800,000 Palestinians into homeless refugees, used ethnic cleansing to destroy over 400 villages, and massacred over 15,000 people. Since then, Israelis have forcibly displaced a stunning 14 million Palestinians, jailed over 1 million people, and launched an average of 10 police raids every single day. The cruelty Israel has shown towards Palestinians for 75 years has been unending, and the path to justice seems like a long road. Even though Muslims outnumber Jews in France by 15 to 1, their support of Palestine is not democratically reflected. Paris has long considered itself as Europe's primary diplomat on the world stage, but many say they do nothing to rein in Israel's daily atrocities and falsely label Palestinian supporters as being against Judaism and Jews. Rarely admitted in the Western media, but common knowledge globally, Israel has turned Gaza into the world's largest prison, where hundreds of Palestinians are murdered by Israelis each year for their land, homes, and beliefs. Israel is currently waging one of its nearly annual wars on Gaza and have killed dozens and wounded over 150 people in the past several days. As many Palestinians remind, the Nakba is ongoing, even if the West would like to ignore it. On May 15th, the United Nations will, for the first time ever, commemorate the massacre, theft, and genocide of 75 years ago. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of people have once again taken to the streets of Tel Aviv to protest against judicial reforms proposed by the cabinet of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The demonstrators held up flares and chanted slogans against Netanyahu, with many saying the surge in the onslaught on Palestinians and the recent attacks on the Gaza Strip is an attempt to divert attention from the regime's internal crisis. Israelis have been holding similar rallies for 19 consecutive weeks now, despite Netanyahu's decision to put the plans on hold. The so-called reforms would give the cabinet greater control over the judiciary. Critics say that it will remove vital checks and balances and hand unlimited power to the cabinet. Moscow says Ukraine has used British long-range cruise missiles to target two industrial sites in the Russian-held city of Luhansk. The defense ministry said Russian forces have gained control over another block in the eastern city of Bakhmut. But a senior Ukrainian military commander said that Kiev's forces are advancing along parts of the front line near Bakhmut. People in Thailand are going to the polls in an election that pits the conservative military-backed government against the pro-democracy opposition. Around 52 million people are eligible to vote. It will choose 500 members of parliament. The main opposition, the Thai Party, was ahead in the final opinion polls. It seeks to curb the power and spending of Thailand's king and bring about economic prosperity. On the other hand, the military-backed incumbent, Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, says that he is the only candidate capable of saving Thailand from chaos. The new premier will be chosen jointly by the 500 elected MPs and 250 Senate members appointed by the junta. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah,
the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong, enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the House Foreign Affairs Committee plans to move forward with holding Secretary of State Antony Blinken in contempt of Congress for failing to comply with a congressional subpoena. The House Affairs Committee is aiming for a floor vote in early June. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The House Foreign Affairs Committee plans to move forward with holding Secretary of State Antony Blinken in contempt of Congress for failing to comply with a congressional subpoena. The committee is aiming for a floor vote in early June, the panel's Republican chairman told CBS News. It's a plan I would rather not take, but it's necessary, committee chairman Michael McCall said in an interview on the eve of the 11th of May deadline to provide State Department records to the House committee. The GOP-led committee issued a subpoena in late March for an internal, confidential State Department document known as a dissent cable which had been written by 23 of the department's employees in Kabul, Afghanistan, that warned, according to the Wall Street Journal, that Kabul would fall after the Biden administration's planned withdrawal deadline of 31st of August 2021. The journal's report also said that the cable pointed out that Taliban were gaining territory quickly, and that the cable suggested ways of speeding up the evacuation from Kabul. Michael McCaul has for weeks been warning that he would subpoena Antony Blinken if he did not turn over the dissent cable and his response. This would be the first time a Secretary of State has ever been in contempt of Congress, Michael McCaul said. During the Trump administration, House Democrats threatened to hold then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in contempt of Congress for records related to a Senate investigation into Hunter Biden. The contempt threat was dropped after the documents were provided to the House committee. Asked about the timeline for the contempt resolution against Antony Blinken, Michael McCaul said he plans to move swiftly, with the committee scheduled to consider the measure on 24th of May, which would be followed by a vote by the full House by early June. Still, McCaul said, "We are giving Antony Blinken ample time to respond. It's important to note this is a criminal contempt as well. It will be voted out of the House and go into judicial proceedings after that." As part of the committee's efforts to reach middle ground with the State Department, Michael McCaul said he had offered to review the cable in a private setting instead of requiring the document to be delivered to the committee. He had also suggested that the State Department could redact the names of the officials who signed the memo, the committee said. Just hours before the 11th of May deadline passed, a State Department spokesman told reporters, "The department has already offered a classified briefing and a summary of the dissent channel cable, as well as the department's response to the cable. We believe that this information has been sufficient to meet what the committee has requested thus far, but we, again, will continue to engage with them." The website of voanews.com, Voice of America, has also covered this story and tells us more. The U.S. State Department said on Monday, 8th of May, it will not fulfill U.S. lawmakers' request for the full Biden administration report on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. "It's unfortunate that despite having received a classified briefing on the dissent channel cable, as well as a written summary that the House Foreign Affairs Committee continues to pursue this unnecessary and unproductive action," State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel told reporters. Vedant Patel added, "Nevertheless, we will continue to respond to appropriate oversight inquiries and provide Congress the information that it needs to do its job while protecting the ability of State Department employees to do theirs." House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Michael McCaul called on U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken last month to release the administration's after-action report on the chaotic August 2021 U.S. withdrawal from Kabul, Afghanistan. "There is a strong public interest in the department sharing the results of its after-action review to the fullest extent possible," Michael McCaul wrote, noting large portions of the report are marked as sensitive but unclassified or unclassified. According to McCaul, the 87-page marked March 2022 after-action review contains numerous unexplained redactions and directly contradicts the Biden administration's public statements, which largely blamed the failures of the withdrawal on the previous administration of President Donald Trump. Michael McCaul asked the State Department to release the full report by Friday, 5th of May. McCaul said on Monday, 8th of May, the State Department has also failed to comply with its subpoena to release the July 2021 cable from diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul using the dissent channel. The department is now in violation of its legal obligation to produce these documents and must do so immediately, McCall wrote in a letter to Antony Blinken on Monday. As noted above, should the department fail to comply with its legal obligation, the committee is prepared to take the necessary steps to enforce a subpoena, including holding you in contempt of Congress and/or initiating a civil enforcement proceeding. The House Foreign Affairs Committee has conducted oversight hearings into the withdrawal, including the 26th of August 2021 suicide bomb at Kabul Airport that killed 13 U.S. service members and 170 Afghan civilians. The Biden administration report said decisions made by the Trump administration to negotiate with the Taliban and set a withdrawal date for U.S. troops prevented an orderly U.S. evacuation from Kabul. When you look at what President Biden inherited, the timeline that was required and the agreement that was reached in the Trump administration, the president did everything he could to manage that situation, Democratic Representative David Cicilline, a member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, told Voice of America last month. But there are a set of decisions made by the prior administration that made that more difficult. The U.S. State Department briefed lawmakers late last month on contents of the cable and the report. Michael McCall, a Republican from Texas, told Voice of America that was not sufficient. Michael McCall said, "I think if you redact the names, that Congress has the right to know that content, and that's all we ask from the Secretary of State. You can redact the names, we'll review it in a classified setting," he said. "But I want to know firsthand the content. I don't want it filtered through your people."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues: how Azerbaijan is playing on the harp of the West, and also India and Bangladesh trying to move away from the US dollar. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how Azerbaijan is playing on the harp of the West. And we shall also take a look at India, Bangladesh trying to move away from the US dollar.
In an attempt to disrupt regional peace, the Zionist regime has found a new market in Baku to sell its ammunition. The Azerbaijani president openly stated that Baku had purchased $5 billion worth of weapons from Israel. The volume is now said to have increased and is estimated to be at $7 billion. According to foreign affairs analysts, Turkey and Israel are the main responsible countries for the recent tensions in the South Caucasus. The Turkish government has also been trying to change the borders of South Armenia as Ankara seeks to expand its influence in the South Caucasus region.
On the directions of the Western powers, Azerbaijan seems to be working to fulfill the nefarious interests of the US and the UK in the region. providing a corridor to Turkey toward Azerbaijan via Sunik. NATO, through Turkey, wants to expand its reach to the Caspian Sea and further towards China, thus posing a serious threat to the regional security and peace. The evil designs of Turkey and Azerbaijan in the West-East Corridor are planned and supported by the Western powers. Iran, on the other hand, has provided Armenia with the geopolitical and geoeconomic opportunities to become a transit corridor connecting Russia and Europe to the Persian Gulf and beyond. Within this context, the Indian Foreign Minister S. Jaishankar visited Armenia last year to discuss Armenia's participation in the international North-South Transport Corridor. Armenian-Iranian Railway can reroute the North-South Transport Corridor away from mainland Azerbaijan to Armenia. With the functioning of the Iran-Armenia Railway line, the Baku-Tbilisi-Kars Railroad would lose its importance, thus sidelining Azerbaijan. According to strategic relations experts, the Iranian-Armenian Railway line will be detrimental to Baku's efforts to turn into a regional transit hub, undermining Iran and Armenia's geostrategic position in the region.
Aimed at strengthening cooperation, Iran, India and Armenia have formed a trilateral group. The first political consultation between the three countries took place last month in the Armenian capital, Yerevan. Economic issues, regional communication, prospects to deepen cultural ties and cooperation in various fields was discussed. The trilateral meeting also had talks on the international North-South transport corridor which connects India, Iran and Russia. It's aimed at reducing costs and time in the movement of goods from Mumbai to Moscow.
The International North-South Transport Corridor Agreement was signed between Russia, Iran, and India in 2002, and since then, many other countries have become a part of the deal. In the recent past, the relations between India and Armenia has seen a surge, with the foreign ministers of both countries visiting each other. The ties between Iran and India date back to historic times. Having a common cultural heritage, the relations between Tehran and New Delhi have stood the test of time. In recent years, the Chabahar port has emerged as a key area of interest between the two countries. The port has the potential to serve as a gateway for India to access Central Asia and Afghanistan, while also providing Iran with an alternative trade route to the Persian Gulf. On the other hand, Iran and Armenia, sharing a border, also have robust ties. The two countries have been working together to enhance trade and economic cooperation, with Armenia serving as a transit route for Iran to access the Eurasian Economic Union. The trilateral grouping between India, Iran, and Armenia is expected to pave the way for greater cooperation in a range of areas, including trade, investment, energy, and transportation, and at the same time, maintaining regional peace and security.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by academic and security expert Dr. Swaran Singh from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Iran, India and Armenia have formed a trilateral group to strengthen regional cooperation. In recent months, there have been many high-level meetings as well. So how do you see this close association between the three countries helping in the progress and stability of the region?
Thank you for having me on your show today. I understand your concern about the regional instability in the Caucasus and how countries like Iran and India can contribute to that stability. We need to first underline the fact that Nagorno-Karabakh has been at the center of tensions in the Caucasus, and what is called as the Second Karabakh War had actually taken place for about 44 days in September of 2020, leading to almost 10,000 people dying from both sides in that sense. And certain amount of tension continues in that area. And we understand that Azerbaijan here is clearly supported by a set of countries. For example, Turkey supplies them drones, and I understand lately Pakistan is negotiating to supply JF-17 fighter jets. And of course, lately, Israel is another country which has become much closer along with the United States towards Azerbaijan. And that raises certain concerns in countries like Iran, which have borders with Turkey, with Azerbaijan and Armenia. And in that sense, the countries of India, Iran, and Armenia had their trilateral meeting last month. Though they broadly talked of focusing on economic regional development, talking about deepening of cultural relations, people-to-people relations, communications and connectivity. But at center of it is regional instability and Nagorno-Karabakh being at the center of those tensions. And that has seen not just Iran, but also India increasingly becoming a stakeholder. Of course, India and Iran are the strategic partners for very, very long time, more than two decades. But lately, India and Armenia partnership also is building as part of this Iran-India-Armenia trilateral. And I think in September last year, an agreement, a defense deal was signed between India and Armenia, where India would also be supplying weapons, equipment, and ammunition. Particularly, Pinaka multi-barrel rocket launchers are part of that. So India definitely, along with Iran, is becoming a stakeholder in ensuring regional stability in the Caucasus.
Dr. Singh, Iran, India, and Armenia also discussed the progress on the international north-south transport corridor. So what factors are likely to impact India's Eurasian vision?
International north-south transport corridor that was originally conceived by Iran, India, and Russia is about 7,200 kilometers long corridor. That definitely brings these countries closer. But since then, about 10 other countries have joined that ambition of building international north-south transport corridor. And we understand that both Armenia and Azerbaijan are also part of that. Now, when you look at it, what are India's reasons to promote that kind of a large-scale initiative? Some, of course, experts will tell you that that is perhaps to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative, but of course, India's engagement with these issues precedes and is much earlier. India, for example, has invested majorly into Iran's Chabahar port and wants to use that connection to build connectivity to the larger Eurasian region all the way to Helsinki. Of course, it also means that if India is able to utilize and build that connectivity, India can then bypass, for example, going through Pakistan or going through the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor infrastructure and even reach Afghanistan using Chabahar as the hub and then, of course, use rail and road links to other countries in the region.
Dr. Singh, ties between Azerbaijan and Israel can lead to instability in the region, impacting other countries as well. How do you view Israeli foreign minister's recent statements about Iran, where he mentioned the close geographical proximity between Iran and Azerbaijan as the basis of its relations with Baku?
I think the comment that you mentioned of Israeli Foreign Minister Ali Cohen has to be understood in the context where the comment is made. We understand that for a long time, since 1991, the relationship between Azerbaijan and Israel were largely one-sided from the Israeli side. And it's only in March this year that Azerbaijan became the first Shia country to open an embassy in Tel Aviv. Now, that finally makes the relationship look like becoming bilateral. In that context, the foreign minister of Israel, Ali Cohen, visited two countries, Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan. And it is in Azerbaijan that the comment that you just mentioned was made. But the world has been clearly aware of Israel's approach towards Iran. For example, Israel has several times mentioned of disallowing Iran, its own pursuit of nuclear deterrent, imagining of an airstrike on Iranian facilities. And that kind of color is being given by Ali Cohen, the foreign minister of Israel, to say that now Azerbaijan and Israel will work together in addressing some of those threat perceptions. And the explanation given is that because Russia and Iran have been lately coming closer, and Azerbaijan sees Russia in the north and Iran in the south, And that is the reason why Azerbaijan wants to get closer to Israel. But I want to underline the fact that Azerbaijan has been far more reluctant and defensive, and actually gone to the extent of denying that it doesn't want to allow Israel to use Azerbaijan territory for any operations against any neighboring countries. So the whole speculation of Israel's Mossad finding a kind of a sanctuary in Azerbaijan, or Israel using territory of Azerbaijan to stage some kind of an airstrikes on Iran, are denied by Azerbaijan. At least, of course, that kind of suspicions still continue to be there. And if that whole Caucasus region becomes unstable, and Nagorno-Karabakh now gets expanded into involving Azerbaijan and Iran as well, that kind of instability is not good for entire Eurasia, and of course, for all major stakeholders in Eurasia's stability and prosperity, including my own country, India, which has major stakes in ensuring stability and prosperity in the region.
Dr. Singh, like you mentioned before, trying to stoke instability in the region, the Zionist regime's designs are to disrupt peace and lead to regional discord and insecurity. So what is your take on it, and how will it have an impact on non-regional countries, including India?
I think the region has already faced several problems over a period of time. The whole dissolution of Soviet Union saw almost a decade plus where countries were just trying to find their borders and define their own nationhood in these regions. So Caucasus is therefore almost just beginning to look like stable, even after that long 6 years of war in Nagorno-Karabakh between 1988 to 94, finally led to certain kind of stability, but it could erupt any time. For example, it erupted in 2020 and led to large number of deaths. So region looks like stable, but can become suddenly again unstable, because countries are still finding their feet, trying to understand their nationhood, find stability and prosperity. And now increasing interest of Israel, for example, in Azerbaijan, and Azerbaijan receiving more and more weapons from Turkey, Pakistan, and now Israel, possibly the new actor in that game.
On that note, I would like to thank academic and security expert Dr. Sawaran Singh from New Delhi for being on the program. Thank you, sir. Now, let's see what people around the world had to say.
Arthur Majakian tweeted, "It's very important. Yerevan hosted the first political consultations in a trilateral format between the foreign ministers of Armenia, Iran, India. The meeting discussed economic issues and regional communication channels, as well as the development of comprehensive relations." Armenian Assassin wrote, "And the United States works with Israel and Azerbaijan and Turkey, which have been masters at genocide and apartheid." The New Arab tweeted, "Like with Israel, Western politicians have ignored Azerbaijan's one-sided aggression, instead portraying it as a conflict where both sides are responsible. The EU has demanded all parties should show restraint." Ksenia Kondrativa writes, "Last week, various delegations from India visited Astrakhan, which is set to become a new hub for Central Asia trade, with India as the international north-south transport corridor develops further."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
India and Bangladesh have announced that the two countries will be moving away from the US dollar in their bilateral trade relations. This decision will enable New Delhi and Dhaka to conduct a portion of their trade in the Indian rupee and the Bangladeshi taka. The agreement is expected to have far-reaching implications on the bilateral trade relations between India and Bangladesh. This move is seen as a significant step by the two countries to strengthen their economic ties.
According to the agreement, the usage of the U.S. dollar will not be eliminated completely. Instead, Bangladesh's exports to India, which were around $2 billion in 2022, will be fully converted into rupees and takas. On the other hand, $2 billion out of approximately $13.69 billion of India's exports to Bangladesh in the previous fiscal year will be paid in rupees. The rest will be paid in dollars. To facilitate these transactions, two Bangladeshi banks will open accounts in two Indian banks and vice versa. This move will allow easier currency conversion and make the process smoother for the business. More banks from both the countries are predicted to gradually join the course. However, some issues still remain in the process of eliminating the dollar and using domestic currencies in bilateral trade. Abdul Matloub Ahmed, the head of the Bangladeshi India Chamber of Commerce and Industry, stated that the procedural steps are currently underway and may take several months to complete. Business establishments of both the countries have welcomed this step towards de-dollarization and have been working with the central banks of both countries to allow currency conversion.
India and Bangladesh's move towards using their domestic currencies in bilateral trade is a significant step towards de-dollarization. Economic experts say that conducting trade in local currencies helps countries reduce pressure on their dollar assets. This move comes at a time when India has accelerated its de-dollarization process in foreign trade, which highlights the pressure that the dollar has put on the foreign exchange reserves of emerging countries like India.
The growing awareness of de-dollarization is not just a matter of risk aversion anymore. It is a trend that is likely to gain momentum in the future as countries seek to diversify their settlement currencies in international trade. Before Bangladesh, 18 countries, including Russia, Germany, the UK, Singapore, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Oman, and New Zealand, had already started settling overseas with India in Indian rupees. Tight monetary policies of the U.S. Federal Reserve are making it increasingly unsustainable for India to settle its foreign trade completely in the U.S. dollars. Seeking diversification and increasing settlement in local currencies will help relieve the pressure on India's dollar reserves and facilitate its trade with other countries. The move towards using domestic currencies in bilateral trade also indicates the loss of status of the U.S. dollar among economies. About a quarter of the world's population is directly affected by U.S. financial sanctions. As a result, many countries are pushing towards de-dollarization to evade U.S. sanctions or to avoid becoming the next target, as the U.S. continues to abuse its dollar hegemony. India's move is just the tip of the iceberg in the global de-dollarization trend.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by academic and senior fellow at Institute of Asia Studies, National University of Singapore, Dr. Sri Ratha Datta from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Miss. Now, India and Bangladesh are working towards using their domestic currencies for their bilateral trade. So to what extent is it going to impact the global financial system?
It was only recently now that they have decided that they'll be, you know, initiating. It's going to be only a very small percentage that they're going to begin with. I think they've decided on something about $2 billion from each side. This was essentially to address two issues. One, of course, we've seen in this pandemic and then the Ukraine crisis, how the dollar was being affected, and also, Bangladesh was facing forex issues. So this was the way of overcoming that. And also, given the fact that we were also losing out in terms of a bit of, this whole transaction that we was doing through the dollars. So it would just kind of simplify the trading, matters. And so between India and Bangladesh, I think that's where we stand just now at a very minimum level amount that we've decided on both sides. In terms of affecting the international, I don't think it would. I think, as I said, it is being initiated through a very small figure just now, which is not even 10% of their total trade. But so having any international impact or global impact right now is, you know, saying it so soon. But if this develops into a much larger practice where we are able to, well, almost move a large section, a large part of the bilateral trade onto the rupees and the taka convertibility, then I guess it may have something. But at this point of time, I don't think there would be any international or global impact.
Dr. Data, many countries have already started using their local currencies to conduct trade. So what challenges and opportunities do you see in the process of eliminating the dollar?
Yes, we've seen that in the recent times, apart from the other international currencies like dollar and sterling and yen and yuan, there are other currencies now that are being used for trade and transaction purposes. So there are, again, It is also about the volatility and how each local domestic currency was pegged on that US, and, you know, given the international volatility just now, that had an impact on it. So I do see, and it will certainly impact on the kind of dominance that dollars have had on every country and its trading practices. So that would affect it some way. But as of now, I think work in progress. It's a very initial days. It's likely to, you know, the practice would come into a greater momentum with some, you know, months and years ahead. So to kind of dislodge US from any of the international transactions is something not that I'm envisaging right now. But it would also give a choice to a lot of other countries. And as I said, a lot of countries, including South Asia, Sri Lanka, you know, Bangladesh, Mauritius, they're all facing a lot of forex issues.
Dr. Data, you've already mentioned this earlier. India has already started de-dollarization process in its trade with other countries as well. So how is it going to impact New Delhi, being one of the largest growing economies of the world?
Yes, India has started. I think we already have over 18 countries with whom we have put this in practice. So far, so good. But, you know, there are always whichever currency we are dealing with, and here it's rupees that we are discussing, there are always some risks which are associated with the internationalization of a rupee, of a currency, and which is rupee here. There would be a certain, the domestic issues like domestic economic, domestic politics, that has a direct impact of, you know, how the rupee fares. Also, you would see that if a large, and, you know, the Indian diaspora who hold rupee balances in India, they often acquire Indian assets. And if this is now, these large holdings are going to be done through the rupee currency, I mean, there obviously is going to be a bit of, you know, differences, and there'll be, I mean, I guess they'll be vulnerable to external shocks, to say it more, you know, simply.
There you have it, academic and senior fellow at the Institute of Asia Studies at National University of Singapore, Dr. Sivirata Data from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, miss. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ari tweeted, "This and Bangladesh is negotiating de-dollarization between them and India. Wild times. Maybe not so cool living in the industrialized, resource-poor West. I learned farming and canning at the moment. How about you folks?" Deep Blue Crypto says, "Former Morgan Stanley analyst Stephen Jen warns the dollar is falling off a cliff. De-dollarization is happening at record speeds, from US dollar share of 73% in 2001 to 55% in 2020. Then it fell off a cliff, losing 8% in a year to 47% in 2020 due to sanctions." India Agri-Trade Tracker wrote, "India and Bangladesh may soon do away with dollar. The development is expected to reduce the cost of trade as well as losses due to rupee dollar and taka dollar differences." Kesilili tweeted, "What impresses me every morning is the bold leader stepping out of the dollar supremacy mentality. Congratulations, Bangladesh, for de-dollarization."
And that was our episode about the relations between Iran, India and Armenia, and also India and Bangladesh moving towards local currencies in their trade deals. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
In the limelight.
In the United States, long lines have formed again next to the southern U.S. border wall in El Paso, Texas, as seen repeated in other parts of the southern U.S. border with Mexico, as migrants anticipated the end of a policy that has allowed immigration agents to quickly expel them from the United States. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. A Texas bill creating a state-run border protection unit has been brought back to life. HB 20 would create a state immigration unit to arrest, apprehend, or detain persons crossing the Texas-Mexico border unlawfully, something that has traditionally been the preserve of the U.S. federal government. The state-run push comes alongside a broader Republican attack on what they characterize as President Joe Biden's open borders policy. While the Biden administration has heavily promoted its new enforcement measures at the border and the federal border patrol reports that encounters with migrants are a quarter below last year, Republicans, however, have described the situation at the U.S. southern border with Mexico in apocalyptic terms. Texas's Attorney General Ken Paxton wrote in a statement on Wednesday, 10th of May, that the brutal reality of Biden administration's agenda should shock the conscience of every American. President Biden's policies allow monstrous gang members, terrorists, human traffickers, drug dealers, and violent criminals into the country, and demonstrate that the president is willing